Post-Hypnotic Press presents The Vanishing Face of Gaia, A Final Warning by James Lovelock. Narrated by Simon Vance, with an introduction for this edition written and narrated by James Lovelock. For my beloved wife, Sandy. Forward by Martin Rees. A little more than 40 years ago, the Apollo 8 astronauts, while orbiting the moon, photographed the whole Earth, its biosphere contrasting with the sterile moonscape where the astronauts left their footprints. The Apollo images raised global awareness that spaceship Earth was vulnerable and that sustaining it was an ecological imperative. But there was a second important influence with similar global resonance, not an image, but an arresting and romantically titled new concept. This was Gaia, the idea that the Earth's biosphere behaves as though it were a single organism. Gaia was the insight of a man who is undoubtedly one of the most original and influential living scientists, James Lovelock. He believes that our species is now putting the Earth under unprecedented stress, and that climate change could lead to a world with much impoverished ecology that is barely habitable by humans. More scarily, and more controversially, he claims that the point of no return may already have been passed. Our planet is nearly 4.5 billion years old. If some aliens had been watching it from afar ever since its birth, what would they have seen? Over nearly all that immense time, changes were incessant, but generally gradual. The continents drifted, the ice cover waxed and waned. Global temperatures rose and fell. Species emerged, evolved, and became extinct. But in just a tiny sliver of the Earth's history, the last one millionth part, a few thousand years, the patterns of vegetation altered much faster than before. This signaled the start of agriculture. The pace of change accelerated as human populations rose and engaged in urban and industrial activity. Consumption of fossil fuels caused an anomalously fast build-up of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The climate changed, and the world started to heat up. If they understood astrophysics, the aliens watching our planet could confidently predict that the biosphere would face doom when the sun brightens and eventually flares up into a red giant star. But could they have foreseen this unprecedented sudden fever less than halfway through the Earth's life? These human-induced changes seemingly occurring with runaway speed. And what might these hypothetical aliens witness in the next 100 years? Will spasms be followed by stability? If so, will our Earth settle into a state that still offers a habitat for humans? Or have our unplanned interventions irrevocably tipped the planet into a new and far hotter climatic state? If so, how many present species of animals and plants will survive? These issues, climate change and loss of biodiversity, have risen high on the international agenda. James Lovelock is helping to keep them there. He is a hero to many scientists, certainly to me. His individualistic career is a welcome counterpoint to the specialized, quasi-industrial style in which most research is conducted. In the 1960s, he designed an instrument that was so sensitive at detecting minute traces of atmospheric pollutants that many colleagues refused to believe his claims. He is beholden to no institution. He ranges freely across the disciplinary boundaries that too often constrain institutional thinkers. The flavor of James Lovelock's mind and personality shine through in this important and highly readable book. He writes clearly, even entertainingly, with many apt analogies, but he writes also with passion, and his thoughts are grounded in a lifetime of distinguished work. He is both a fine scientist and an eloquent advocate of action. Many of us still hope that our civilization can segue towards a low-carbon future and a lower population, and achieve this transition without trauma and disaster. But that benign outcome demands determined action by governments, urgently implemented. And such urgency won't be achieved unless sustained campaigning can transform public attitudes and lifestyles. Programs to develop clean energy must be accorded worldwide the urgency that the US gave to the Apollo program in the 1960s. Those of us who are scientists should aspire to emulate James Lovelock's inventiveness. All citizens should be inspired by his commitment and altruism. It is no exaggeration to say that our civilization's long-term future depends on whether the call to arms in this riveting book is widely heeded. Martin Rees, Trinity College, Cambridge, January 2009. Chapter 1. The Journey in Space and Time. Icons are important to us. The cross and the scimitar have dominated lives and history for 2 millennia. For some, the icon of greatest meaning is that blue-white vision of the Earth first seen from space by astronauts. That icon is undergoing subtle change as the white ice fades away, the green of forest and grassland fades into the dun of desert, and the oceans lose their blue-green hue and turn a purer swimming pool blue as they too become desert. This is why, at 90 years old, I will try to emulate the astronauts and fly into space to see the Earth from above before it vanishes. I want to catch a glimpse of the Earth I have lived with all my life, even though my most trusted physician, Douglas Chamberlain, has advised me that the risk is too high. I will go, despite the warnings, to recapture that enthralling eureka moment 44 years ago when I was working at the then Center of Space Research, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, in California, and saw with my mind's eye our planet as something possibly unique in the universe, something alive. Since then, I have thought of the word Earth as inadequate to describe the living planet that we inhabit and are a part of. I am grateful to the author William Golding for his suggestion that the name Gaia was more appropriate. Not least among the joys of seeing our live planet from high above will be the simple pleasure of seeing with my own eyes how spherical it is. I had few doubts that this was so, but as with many things in life, as well as in science, we have to take for granted that it is round, even though when on the ground, our eyes tell us it is flat. Imagine my delighted amazement on hearing that my wish to see the Earth from space would soon be fulfilled, and I would see from the sky above New Mexico our sphere of a world in all its glory. In an act of splendid generosity, Sir Richard Branson made the gift and had already founded his own space line, Virgin Galactic, to make it possible. His ultimate upgrade, the flight to space, will let me escape for a few brief minutes the all-pervasive introspection of 21st century life, and allow me to share that transcendental feeling of astronauts that our home is not the house, or the street, or the nation where we live, but the Earth itself. Is there any need to see Gaia, the only living planet in the solar system? After all, despite the recent economic setback, life continues to get better in most of the world. Even the poor in the developed world, although malnourished, are sometimes well enough fed to be obese. There are so many possibilities of entertainment that there is no reason to be bored day or night. Perhaps we no longer need to see the Earth in reality when we can see it so well on Google. It does matter, and more than any other thing. We have to see it as it really is because our lives are wholly dependent upon the living Earth. We could not survive for an instant on a dead planet like Mars, and we need to understand the difference. If we fail to take our planet seriously, we will be like children who take their homes for granted and never doubt that breakfast starts the day. We will not notice, as we enjoy our daily lives, that the cost of our neglect could soon cause the greatest tragedy in the memory of humankind. The Earth, in its, but not our, interests, may be forced to move to a hot epoch, one where it can survive, although in a diminished and less habitable state. If, as is likely, this happens, we will have been the cause. Do not be misled by lulls in climate change when global temperature is constant for a few years, or even, as I write here in the UK in 2008, appears to drop. Holidaymakers and farmers who have endured a miserably cloudy, cool, wet July and August all ask me, where is global warming now? Further away in the Gulf of Mexico, where for several years the surface water was unusually warm, it is now cooler again, and the Arctic has also regained a little of the astounding losses of 2007, although ominously the ice continues to grow thinner.